Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 25th of July, these are our main stories. Boris Johnson has begun his term as Britain's Prime Minister with a major overhaul of senior government positions. Robert Mueller, who investigated Russian interference in the last US presidential election, has again insisted that his report did not clear President Trump of obstructing justice. Also in this podcast, Facebook is fined $5 billion, the largest amount ever imposed on a company for violating consumer privacy. And
the most men would say, why don't you go where you come from? But I said to them, no, you listen to me. You live in my country for 600 years. So you don't tell me that I don't belong here.
The reflections of female Caribbean immigrants to Britain, explored in a new opera. There's been a changing of the guard in Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister. Theresa May, who'd moved in 3 years ago, left to tender her resignation to Queen Elizabeth. She used her final remarks on the steps of Number 10 to thank her supporters.
As I leave Downing Street, my final words are of sincere thanks to my colleagues in government and parliament, to everyone in the building behind me and across the civil service, to the men and women of our armed forces and security services, and to the public servants in our schools, our NHS, our police and the other emergency services. All are inspired by the noble wish to serve their country in the national interest.
Mrs. May was followed to the palace by Boris Johnson, who was asked by the monarch to lead her government. In front of Number 10's iconic black door, Mr. Johnson repeated his pledge to take Britain out of the EU by the end of October.
After 3 years of unfounded self-doubt, it is time to change the record, to recover our natural and historic role as an enterprising, outward-looking and truly global Britain. Generous in temper and engaged with the world. No one in the last few centuries has succeeded in betting against the pluck and nerve and ambition of this country. They will not succeed today.
Our correspondent at Westminster, Rob Watson, watched the day's events.
I do think it's been an absolutely astonishing first few hours and speech and moves from Boris Johnson. And I guess I'd sum it all up as anyone thinking that somehow this would be an emollient Boris Johnson, somehow on the back foot, not at all. It seems to me this is all or nothing. This is Brexit, do or die. And three things really leapt out at me. Number one, this idea that he has not reached out to Remain supporters at all. I mean, he's doubling down on Brexit. It has to be done. Second, that this looks to me like a very radically different new approach to Brexit, because he's not saying that there should be a withdrawal agreement and a transition and then a new relationship. He seems to be saying that all of that needs to be happen almost like one big bang by the 31st of October. And then, of course, the last thing is kind of utterly kind of radical, bold, whatever adjective you like to use, restructuring of the government, with so many people being sacked or resigning.
And what about big appointments?
Well, I guess the ones that are striking is Dominic Raab, for example, as Foreign Secretary, as someone who's very much an ardent Brexiteer, and a man called Stephen Barclay, also a Brexiteer, staying in post as the Brexit Secretary. And really, it's more, rather than the individual names, which mean a lot to many people in Britain, let's face it, it's the idea of what you might almost call a war cabinet, a cabinet that's saying, right, we are all behind Brexit, we're behind the idea of a no-deal Brexit, and anyone who's not really on board with that, they're out.
So this is a PM in a hurry. Well, he doesn't have much time, does he?
No, he doesn't. And, you know, one other veteran journalist said to me as we staggered away from the speech, said, you know, Rob, this looks like a wartime cabinet. It sort of looks like this isn't the end. It's not as if the referendum ended 3 years ago. It's as if the referendum was in full swing. And that is what it feels like. It feels like Boris Johnson has doubled down and he's basically saying, look, it's Brexit, it's me, it's Brexit, or it's bust.
Rob Watson. Well, Andrew Mitchell is an MP with the governing Conservative Party who backed Mr Johnson for the top job. But at the time of the referendum in 2016, Andrew Mitchell campaigned for the UK to remain in the EU. In a BBC interview, he was asked, now that his new Prime Minister says he's willing to take Britain out of the EU without a deal, is he relieved at the clarity or terrified?
I think we've really got to bring the impasse to an end. And although, as you rightly say, I voted to remain, I am a Democrat and I accepted the decision of my constituents and the country in that referendum. And the problem is that the establishment in Britain, which is overwhelmingly Remain, has tended to argue, although they would never admit it, that those who voted Leave were too stupid to make that decision. And I just don't think that's tenable in a democracy. So we've really got to leave now. And I think there's a lot of merit in doing what Boris has done, which is to say to our friends and partners in the European Union, look, we're going to leave on October the 31st. We can't go on facing this deep internal division in Britain that we've got at the moment and the catastrophe in terms of the lack of respect and plummeting of Britain's international reputation. We've got to bring this to a head. We're going to leave on October the 31st. But look, let's do a deal. That's in all of our interests. Let's do a deal on the key things that matter and get this over the line. And I think that's the right decision now.
Right. Well, let's talk about this possible deal. And indeed, Donald Tusk has said that he looks forward to hearing Mr. Johnson's plans in detail, as he put it. What is he going to offer to the European Union to get through this particular issue of the Northern Ireland backstop, which he totally refuses to countenance? Because as far as the European Union is concerned, that is central to the functioning of the single European market.
Well, I think you've got to start from the basis that everyone involved in the issue of the Irish backstop, and I mean everyone, the Southern Irish government, the Northern Irish politicians, the DUP, the government at Westminster, all say that there is no question of having a hard border in Northern Ireland. And once you accept and internalise that fact, it ought to be possible to do a deal which allows the border to continue to be free-flowing as it is at the moment without offending against the basic principles of the European Union. And I would have thought that in a spirit of goodwill, bearing in mind that no deal as defined is bad for the UK and it's bad for the Low Countries and Germany, it's even worse for Ireland, it ought to be possible to come up with arrangements which...
But they've spent 3 years trying to find those arrangements and they haven't been able to.
I think a lot of the problem in the last 3 years is that this has been seen by the British government and by the British establishment as a damage limitation exercise instead of the opportunity for Britain, which Boris set out.
So in other words, you're saying that the civil service has been acting in bad faith?
No, I'm not saying anything of the sort. What I'm saying is that the can-do attitude, which Boris Johnson exemplified on the steps of Downing Street when he went in today, that is the attitude we now need to take. And that's the right attitude to dealing with the deal. It's the right attitude to dealing with the backstop and the border in Northern Ireland. And I'm sure that once everyone internalises that we are going on October the 31st, that is the right way to handle these negotiations.
The Tory MP Andrew Mitchell talking there to Tim Franks. To Washington, D.C. now, where the former U.S. special counsel Robert Mueller has been answering questions in public for the first time since the release of his report on possible Russian interference in the 2016 election. His inquiry failed to establish that members of Donald Trump's campaign conspired with Moscow, but it also failed to reach a conclusion on whether or not Mr. Trump was guilty of the crime of obstruction of justice and pointedly didn't exonerate him. Mr. Mueller has been giving testimony in front of both the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, as Gary O'Donoghue reports.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you swear or affirm under penalty?
It was one of the most anticipated congressional events in decades. The special counsel, against his will, brought by subpoena before two House committees to get a grilling on his 448-page report. The two-year inquiry had involved 2,800 subpoenas, more than two dozen Russians indicted, and seven people either jailed or pleading guilty. But from the start, Mr. Mueller said his testimony would be limited and confined to what was in the report, and he wasn't joking.
I would direct you to the report. I'm just going to leave it in, as it appears in the report. I refer you to the report. I'd refer you to the coverage of this in the report.
When the committee could get him to answer substantively, he largely confined himself to single-word answers. Yes and no and true on more than 100 occasions in the first part of the hearing. Here's the Democratic chair, Jerry Nadler, asking whether the president had been interviewed by the inquiry.
Did the president refuse the request to be interviewed by you and your team?
Yes.
Yes. And is it true that you tried for more than a year to secure an interview with the president?
Yes.
And is it true that you and your team advised the president's lawyer that, quote, an interview with the president is vital to our investigation, close
yes.
quote? But the president still refused to sit for an interview by you or your team?
True.
At times, Mr. Mueller seemed somewhat hesitant with the contents of his own report, declining to agree with statements that were in the document and infuriating Republicans. John Ratcliffe wanted to know why the presumption of innocence wasn't extended to the president on the question of obstruction of justice. The report had said that Mr. Trump was neither guilty nor exonerated.
Can you give me an example other than Donald Trump where the Justice Department determined that an investigated person was not exonerated because their innocence was not conclusively determined?
I cannot, but this is a unique situation.
Okay, well, you can't. Time is short. I've got 5 minutes. Let's just leave it at you can't find it because I'll tell you why. It doesn't exist.
Robert Mueller has already said that a sitting president can't be indicted. Constitutionally, it's for Congress to prosecute through the process of impeachment. But when another Republican, Ken Buck, pressed the former special counsel on what could happen after a president left office, Mr. Mueller was clear.
Could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
Perhaps the most animated the former special counsel became was when he was pressed about questions of political bias in his own team. That's been a common thread of presidential attacks.
I have been in this business for almost 25 years, and in those 25 years, I have not had occasion once to ask somebody about their political affiliation. It is not done. What I care about is the capability of the individual to do the job and do the job quickly and seriously and with integrity.
And Jackie Speier, a Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, raised another of the president's common accusations that the whole Russia interference in the 2016 election was a hoax.
Would you agree that it was not a hoax, that the Russians were engaged in trying to impact our election?
Absolutely. That was not a hoax. The indictments we returned against the Russians, two different ones, were substantial in their scope, using the scope word again. And I think we have underplayed to a certain extent in that aspect of our investigation that has and would have long-term damage to the United States that we need to move quickly to address.
Democrats were hoping to put a face and a voice onto some of the most explosive details in the report. But thanks to Robert Mueller's tight-lipped approach, they haven't really succeeded in doing so. That will disappoint many in the party who saw this as a potential springboard for impeachment proceedings and will serve to largely neutralise the Russia issue in electoral terms.
That report by Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. As the language politicians use about race comes under scrutiny, a new opera is exploring the immigrant experience here in the UK. Memories in Mind, Women of the Windrush, celebrates the stories of the women from the Caribbean who came by boat to Britain between 1948 and 1971. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones compiled this report.
I've seen it as my role to document the stories of women like my mother and my aunts and their friends. Because that was something I hadn't really seen before, portrayed in opera stories of women from the Caribbean of that generation that came over during the Windrush period.
The British composer Shirley J. Thompson wanted to give those women a voice by interweaving their experiences into an opera.
An African continent.
The women were part of the Windrush generation, a reference to the ship that brought the first workers to Britain in 1948.
In Jamaica, they couldn't find work. Discouraged but full of hope, they sailed for Britain.
London is the place for me.
Their spokesman sings his thanks to Britain.
London, this lovely city.
But the reality was very different for the women who inspired the opera.
My name is Ivy Jones.
Ivy Jones, who's 91, arrived in London from Jamaica 60 years ago. Living in just one room, her first job was in an asbestos factory.
They couldn't get nobody for that job because asbestos, first it was a bad thing and people don't want to work in it. And second, it was a cheap job. But black people have to take the job that English people don't want.
So did you feel unwelcome?
Yes, you feel unwelcome, but I didn't care about that. You know, English people didn't treat black people very well. The most men would say, why don't you go where you come from? But I said to them, no, you listen to me. You live in my country for 600 years. So you don't tell me that I don't belong here. I belong here. Slave labor build the economy. And that's my legacy. And I am going to get my share. And that just shut them up.
We worked and we toiled to build this land.
So recently I was waiting for a taxi, minding my own business. And a man asked me, why hadn't you gone back? Go back to where you've come from.
That was this year.
Mm-hmm.
Dame Jocelyn Barrow is 90. She's been living in this country since she arrived from Trinidad as a postgraduate student in 1959. She went on to help found the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination.
Great strides were made. We were making great improvement. We got black MPs, etc. And then with this Brexit situation, it has brought out people's... It has given them an authority. They feel a right to ask you why you're here and why haven't you gone back. The underlying message was we want to be a white, independent country, just as Trump is trying to do. And people take their cues from that and feel that they have the right and the liberty to become more racially abusive than they did in the past.
By showcasing the struggles of the Windrush women, Shirley J. Thompson hopes to share the lessons of the past with people in the present. And throughout her own career, she's faced plenty of challenges herself.
I've had many obstacles. I've had many doors closed, phones not answered and letters not answered. But I wouldn't be put down because I didn't get responses from key people. And I think I've had to be particularly resilient to keep going.
But do you think that your experience has been because you're a black woman?
Nobody has said that overtly, but I suspect that has been the case, yes.
That report compiled by Rebecca Jones. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come...
Everything is only measured by money. How can you put a price tag for a culture?
The conflict between development and tradition in Lapland. Facebook will pay $5 billion, the largest fine ever imposed on a company for violating consumer privacy. The social media giant has promised to create an independent privacy panel and to strengthen oversight. But some critics believe the fine isn't large enough. Here's our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
This all goes to the heart of how Facebook handles its users' personal information, how that data that they collect from us is shared. Back in 2012, they made a promise to regulators that they would take adequate measures to protect that information. Then last year, they disclosed that actually some of it had been let loose, that a third-party application developer collected user information from Facebook and shared it with a company called Cambridge Analytica, a political consulting firm that claimed to have influenced the 2016 US presidential election with that social media data. That sparked a huge scandal that launched this investigation, and here we are 16 months later with what is a record-breaking fine for the company.
Well, you say record-breaking, and $5 billion is a lot of money. Why is there a view it should be more?
Because when you look at the size of Facebook and its cash flow, which really, you could liken it to kind of a gushing river, then the amount it's been fined amounts to the kind of money Facebook can generate in one single month. And given how strongly people feel about these privacy violations, they say this is a tiny slap on the wrist. It's nothing for this company. And that the other stipulations in this settlement, which require it to change the way it does business, are not enough to fundamentally address the root causes of this. And that's why the settlement, even within the agency that reached it, there was a divide. You saw the Republican-controlled panel vote along party lines with the dissent by two Democrats who felt that more should have been done.
And have we had any reaction from Facebook itself?
Well, Mark Zuckerberg came out and said that this would lead to major structural changes in how Facebook builds its products. He went on to say we have a responsibility to protect people's privacy. There were more sort of similar comments from the company's legal counsel. But I think there has been some scepticism amongst critics who say, hang on a second, we've heard promises like this from Mark Zuckerberg before. And there was disappointment that he wasn't held more personally accountable. If you look at the executives from Cambridge Analytica, they were already held accountable in a separate case. Why isn't Mark Zuckerberg being held to the same standard?
Michel Fleury. The second deadliest Ebola outbreak in history has claimed the lives of more than 1,700 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo since the start of the outbreak nearly a year ago. Now, a local MP says he doesn't want residents to be guinea pigs for a new vaccine after a separate, different experimental drug had already been used. Our correspondent Louise de West explains.
It's a battle over control. On one side, you have international charities and the World Health Organization pushing for the deployment of a second vaccine. On the other, a number of representatives in the DRC who say this second vaccine won't help control the outbreak. They say the introduction of a new vaccine in a community that already distrusts Ebola health workers could exacerbate suspicions. What's more, the new vaccine produced by Johnson & Johnson would have to be administered in two doses, 2 months apart. That's far from ideal in a region where people often have to flee due to insecurity. Johnson & Johnson have recognized that and suggest their vaccine could be used as a protection for people outside the affected areas. There is already an experimental vaccine being used in the current Ebola outbreak, manufactured by Merck. This one can protect against Ebola within about 10 days. Already 170,000 people have been inoculated. But as the outbreak continues to spread, health workers have raised concerns that the stock of the Merck vaccine in the DRC could fall short of demand. There are up to 100 new cases appearing each week, and the authorities are clearly struggling to control the outbreak.
Louise de West. Lapland is often described as Europe's last great wilderness. It stretches across Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia, high above the Arctic Circle. And it's the home of the Sami, Europe's last remaining indigenous people who still live off the land. However, life for the Sami people is changing. Climate change is affecting the Arctic more than any other part of the earth, and it's damaging the Sami's traditional livelihood. But that's not the only threat. As temperatures rise, new business opportunities are opening up in the Arctic, which many Sami people say are putting more pressure on their way of life. Erika Benka went to Finnish Lapland and sent us this report.
I came to Lapland in early May. Normally, there would be a lot of snow underground at this time of the year. But there's just a few patches left in this forest in Inari, the capital of Sami heartland. I've come here to meet Anna Morottaja, who's checking up on her family's reindeer.
When the snow melts, then
the basic best food of reindeer. This reindeer moss freezes. The reindeer can't dig it. They can't even smell it through the ice. That's starvation then. And it affects the income of reindeer herder.
But that's not the only pressure. As temperatures rise and the sea ice melts, there's now an opportunity for a shipping route to open through the Arctic Ocean. There's also a plan to build a railway across northern Lapland to move goods from Central Europe all the way to the Norwegian port of Kirkenes on the Arctic Ocean. The railway would also help to exploit the region's natural resources. There's copper, nickel, cobalt and zinc here. But the Sami parliament is fiercely opposed to these plans. Tina Sanila Aikio is their president. I spoke to her on the bank of the fast-flowing U2 River, next to her office.
We live from the nature, and it will cut the reindeer grazing areas into two. There will be more forest logging, for example. It will be transporting oil and gas products from Norway and Russia. It will bring the mining industry to the Sami homeland area in Finland. It's the worst night where we are facing at the moment, concrete one. Of course, climate change is another one, but it's not as concrete than the Arctic Railway.
Supporters insist that it will boost Lapland's economy. The Finnish government says a final decision hasn't been made about the Arctic Railway or its route. But Heini Veslin, who teaches traditional Sami handicrafts in Sevettijärvi near the Russian border, fears being forced to move.
Those plans I have seen, so it seems like it would go straight through our house. And my opinion is that it will be genocide.
Strong words, but the plans are a painful reminder of the past. Heini is a skald Sami. Many of her people were forced to leave their ancestral lands in Russia and resettle in Finland.
Everything is only measured by money. But how can you put a price tag for a culture?
A sentiment echoed by Anne Marat Labba, a young Sami woman I met on the border with Sweden.
There are some people that say mines bring jobs and wealth, and they want to build mines here because they think it's empty, but they forget that we are there. What do you actually need in life? You can't eat gold.
Development clashing with the traditional way of life and the environment, increasingly seen the world over. Some claim they can coexist, but many Sami people disagree.
That report by Erika Benke. Finally, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Well, it's definitely not a flag. In fact, it's a polka dot blanket. That's right. A Russian junior pole vault champion has caused a stir by waving a pink polka dot blanket instead of a flag to celebrate her victory. The doping ban imposed on Russia 4 years ago prevented Aksana Gatalina from competing under her flag at the European Under-20 Championships. Here's our regional editor, Mike Saunders.
Aksana Gatalina says she was just fooling around with the joy of winning in the Swedish city of Borås. With no flag allowed, she paraded the first thing to hand, the blanket that keeps her warm between rounds. Pro-Kremlin commentators seized on the gesture. They said being deprived of a flag showed the injustice of punishing the new generation for the state-sponsored doping that clouds Russia's past successes. But detractors on social media said Russia had only itself to blame.
Mike Saunders. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.